Algerian authorities say 43 people have died in a suicide bombing today. The bomb was concealed in a car parked near a police training academy. No one has claimed responsibility for today's blast. The Venezuelan government has taken control of the country's cement plants that are owned by Mexico. Negotiators for both sides failed to reach a deal nationalizing the firms. Two other cement companies, owned by a French firm and a Swiss corporation, have already worked out terms of a nationalization agreement. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has set out a plan to nationalize several industries as a path towards socialism, including telecommunications and electricity firms. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Freestyle Releasing, presenting Bottle Shock, the true story of a Napa Valley wine tasting competition, starring Alan Rickman, Bill Pullman, and Freddie Rodriguez.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Medical Group. Same-day or next-day appointments with a primary care physician are now available. Appointments can be made at 1-866-PROVENA. At the Provena Medical Group, family doctors are concerned with treating people, not just illness.
Have a question about digital radio or digital TV? Come to the WILL Digital Information Fair and Open House Sunday, August 24th from 2 to 4:30 at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana. Get your questions answered, tour Campbell Hall, meet our on-air hosts, and enter to win a digital TV or digital radio. We hope to see you Sunday, August 24th at Campbell Hall.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the history of the Cold War and look back to what many people would argue would be the defining moment of the Cold War. This was a span of 13 days when the world had its closest ever brush with nuclear destruction. What we're talking about here is the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, there are some people who would argue that the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union did not engage in nuclear war was just a matter of luck. However, our guest for this morning, journalist Michael Dobbs, takes a very different view. We'll be talking about his newly published book, 1 Minute to Midnight, the subtitle Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. It's published by Knopf. And in the book, he makes the argument that while Kennedy and Khrushchev were indeed separated by fear and misunderstanding, that as this crisis unfolded, they became determined to take control of the military forces that they themselves had unleashed before it was too late. And the book tells that story, concentrating very, very closely on the very last day of this crisis, what has come to be called Black Saturday, October the 27th. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk this morning with our guest, Michael Dobbs. He is a reporter for The Washington Post and has spent much of his career as a foreign correspondent covering the collapse of communism. He's joining us this morning by phone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, that number is 333-9455, so questions are welcome. We do also have a toll-free line, so if we'd be listening around Illinois, Indiana, or even across the country on the Internet, and it would be a long-distance call, use that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people when they call in is just they try to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along, but anybody who is listening is a welcome to call. Mr. Dobbs, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
We appreciate it. Before going on to talk about how this crisis unfolded and how the two governments and the two leaders responded, I expect that probably a lot of folks, the very first question they have about this would be something like this. Why is it that the Soviet leadership decided to place these missiles in Cuba, taking what had to have been seen by the United States as a extremely provocative action and one that you would expect would get a very strong response?
Right. It was a huge gamble for Nikita Khrushchev, who was the Soviet leader at the time. But just to give you a little bit of historical background, Fidel Castro had come to power in Cuba in 1959. He began nationalizing American assets on the island, executing his political opponents, and gradually revealed himself to be a communist, formed an alliance with Moscow. The Kennedy administration, both for its own reasons and for political reasons, they were under strong pressure from the Republicans for allowing this to happen in an island so close to the United States. They were determined to get rid of Castro, and of course there'd been the Bay of Pigs fiasco in 1961 when a small band of Cuban exiles supported by the CIA was defeated on the beaches at the Bay of Pigs. And after that, the Kennedy administration waged what amounted to a secret war against Castro. It was known as Operation Mongoose. So both Castro and Khrushchev had reason to believe that the U.S. was out to get rid of Castro by one means or another. So for Khrushchev, I think he had various motivations. One motivation, a very important motivation, was to defend the socialist revolution in Cuba. A second one was to even the balance of power. At the time, the U.S. had many more missiles and nuclear bombers that could hit the that could hit Russia than the other way around. So by deploying some of his missiles in Cuba, Khrushchev helped even the balance of power. And the third motivation was that he had been watching in great frustration as the United States deployed nuclear missiles around the periphery of the Soviet Union. So he wanted simply to get even with Uncle Sam, as he put it. He wanted to put a hedgehog down the pants of Uncle Sam, was one of his colorful turns of phrases. So he thought he could solve a lot of problems by this spectacular gesture. Mm.
And that's something that perhaps people don't always realize or take account of. And this is something that became very important, an important bargaining chip as the crisis developed. And that is that the United States had missiles in Turkey that could strike the Soviet Union. So I suppose Khrushchev thought it was only, in one sense, it was only fair for him to put missiles in Cuba that close to the United States that could also strike the United States.
Right. He said to his advisors that it's about time that the Americans got a taste of their own medicine. They have never been threatened from abroad the way that we have been threatened all the time. And they should feel like what it's like to live under the nuclear threat as much as we do.
I find myself wondering. I'm sure people wonder what the Soviets, what Khrushchev thought the United States would do, what the United States' reaction would be once they realized that these missiles were there.
Well, his plan was to deploy the missiles in secret. And in fact, they had to send an army across the ocean of 43,000 men, complete with not just the missiles that could hit the United States, but local tactical nuclear missiles that would have been used to destroy American invading force. And, a vast army with all the paraphernalia of a modern army in dozens and dozens of ships were going across the Atlantic. And he thought he could do this in secret and spring the surprise of the deployment of nuclear missiles on Kennedy. And by the time Kennedy discovered it, it would be too late because the missiles would be active and ready to aimed at the American cities and could be launched within an hour or so. But his plans went awry when the U.S. discovered the deployment while it was still happening, and before the missiles had become fully operational. So that gave Kennedy and his advisors a few days to think about their response before deciding what to do exactly. Mm-hmm.
Another point here that I think is interesting, here as you describe it, here the Soviet Union was sending by ship all of these men and all of this material. And the decision, I think, Khrushchev had made this decision to put the missiles there in May. So in the spring and through the summer, this stuff was being shipped to Cuba, and it was not until October that the United States finally realized what was going on and found out what was going on.
Right. So, well, the CIA certainly observed numerous ships, nearly 100 ships making this transatlantic voyage. So they knew perfectly well that something was going on. The question was what? And Khrushchev kept on assuring Kennedy that he was only putting defensive military equipment in Cuba. The question was, and Kennedy believed him initially. So they were very surprised when they discovered that there was not only defensive military equipment, but also offensive military equipment. Now, in other words, missiles that could reach the United States. This was all happening in the run-up to the 1962 midterm congressional elections. Kennedy was under a lot of pressure from the Republicans, and particularly a man called Senator Keating, who had accused him of not doing enough to prevent the consolidation of Castro's power in Cuba and prevent this threat to the United States. So when, on the morning of October 16th, Kennedy was told by the CIA that there were indeed missiles in Cuba, he felt betrayed by Khrushchev, but he also felt under considerable political pressure domestically because he had assured the American people that he would not allow this to happen. So he, for various reasons, he had to make sure that the missiles were removed from Cuba, or, as he put it in a private conversation with his brother Bobby, he felt he could have been impeached.
And this was at a time, just one more point here, I think is interesting about intelligence gathering that people need to remember. This was at a point where we did not have spy satellites. There was nothing like that, that the only way that you could find out what was going on over hostile territory was with an airplane that flew very fast and very high that could fly over that territory and take pictures.
Right. That was the U-2, which flew at 70,000 feet. And was able to take, it had an extraordinary camera on board with a very long focal length. And was able to take extraordinary pictures. And it was the U-2 that discovered the presence of the missiles in Cuba. And then later on, the U.S. sent low-level planes over at 1,000 feet, U.S. Navy and Air Force planes that got better pictures, more intelligible to ordinary people than the U-2 pictures, which could really only be interpreted by experts.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Dobbs. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, has been, for most of his career, a foreign correspondent. He covered the collapse of communism and is the author of a new book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The title is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. The book is published by Knopf. It's out now. If you want to take a look at it, just head out to the bookstore. And you want to call in here, that's welcome as well, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that on the American side here, right once the United States and the Kennedy administration became aware of exactly what was going on here, that he was under very strong pressure from the military to attack, either to attack the missiles and to destroy them, or to launch a full-scale invasion of Cuba.
That's right. The military was very upset when Kennedy decided as a first step that he would not attack the missile sites. Instead, he would impose a naval blockade, or as he called it, a quarantine. And in fact, the Air Force chief at that time was Curtis LeMay, sometimes known as Bombs Away LeMay, who was very blunt character and told Kennedy to his face that this was worse than the appeasement at Munich, Chamberlain's trip to Munich in 1939 to appease Adolf Hitler. And, of course, that was a terrible family insult for Kennedy because his father, Joe Kennedy, had been the ambassador to Britain and had been labeled as an appeaser. So for LeMay to accuse President Kennedy of appeasement was really quite an insult.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the points that you make, and I think you make a number of interesting kind of retrospective points in the afterword to the book, talking about how it is this affected American thinking afterwards and perhaps to this day. And one of the points that you make was that after this crisis, there was a serious reconsideration of the idea that nuclear war was winnable. So it the experience apparently within the military changed the minds of a lot of people. Having said that, though, if you go back when the crisis was just developing, how were they thinking about this? And were they actually thinking about what the implications might be if things truly did escalate to the point of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, they were thinking in terms of a nuclear war, particularly in the military, and they thought they could win such a war. And the United States enjoyed, you know, great superiority at the time. So it's true that in terms of winners and losers, who'd be left with standing after a nuclear exchange, the United States would come out on top. But and that was the thinking of the military, who were prepared to contemplate a first strike against the Soviet Union. But the way Kennedy looked at it is that, you know, even though we could devastate the Soviet Union, even if just one Soviet missile got through, he asked the military, how many American casualties would that result in? And they said around 500,000 or around 600,000. And that took his breath away, because that was more casualties than in the entire Civil War. And he said that it's taken us a century to recover from the Civil War. So the idea of accepting, you know, even 500,000 casualties to win a war against the Soviet Union was really unacceptable to him. And after the missile crisis, then the Soviets began a big nuclear buildup. And so the idea of winning a nuclear war after the missile crisis became obviously unfeasible. I mean, it really underlined the fact that a nuclear war couldn't be won in terms that rational people would think you could win it.
We have a caller here to bring in, someone listening in Indiana, in Morgansport, Indiana. This is on our toll-free line, line number 4. Well, let's go there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I was in high school that period, and I'm one of those kids who ducked under his seat. And I remember now that I can go back over it and remember the intense indoctrination about Russia. And I remember some test that was run about showing a photograph of a road with a lot of, like, probably trees on the left and the right going off into infinity. And they used different groups. And one group, they told them that it was in Russia, and most of the responses were that it was evil, there were people lurking behind the trees. I wonder if you could get into the sociological thing about this, whether anybody actually played that card, because I remember there were children with me who thought, you know, this was the end, and were quite scared, and in a sense we were prepared for that kind of outcome by the indoctrination that started in grade school, actually. Thanks a lot.
Well, of course, the Soviet Union was the evil empire of its day, the original evil empire. And, you know, we certainly, you know, I think it was, of course, a totalitarian country, a dictatorship. So there was, you know, some basis for the Reagan's later description of the Soviet Union as an evil empire. But, of course, you know, Americans tend to exaggerate the threat. And you know, in the end, Khrushchev and the communist leaders of the Soviet Union, you know, they didn't want a war any more than we wanted a war. So, you know, they were, although they represented a completely different system, they also, you know, realized the limitations of that system. And I think even when Khrushchev deployed the missiles to Cuba, his aim was not to attack the United States. That would have been completely unfeasible for him. But Americans, you know, often perceived this as a struggle between two opposing ways of life, and it would have to end with the victory of one or the other. And, of course, it actually did end. The Cold War did end with the victory of the democracies led by the United States, but it happened in a different way. It didn't happen in a military way. It happened in an economic competition.
We were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that the military was really pressing the president and his advisors to attack Cuba, and that what they decided to do instead was this what was called the quarantine to stop ships that were going in to look and see what was on there and to allow them to go through if it was food or medicine or anything else, but if it was military, that they would stop them. And this became the administration's plan. And though going back to the idea of the attack on Cuba, at any point did John Kennedy seriously consider that option, or was that just absolutely no consideration given to that even from the very first?
No, it was very seriously considered. And had he had to make a decision that first day, he would have probably gone with an airstrike. Fortunately, he had a week to think about it because he was able to keep the fact of the Soviet deployment secret from the American people and from the Soviets, that the U.S. had discovered it, secret for a week. So that gave them a week to debate and consider all the options. And they decided in the end that it was too dangerous to go with an airstrike and invasion because that could provoke what Defense Secretary McNamara called a spasm response from the other side. And, you know, with the hindsight of 45 years, we can now see that they were correct, because had the U.S. Staged an airstrike against the missile sites, an invasion would probably have become inevitable because there'd have been so much chaos in Cuba. Soviet soldiers would have been killed. What we now know that we didn't know, the administration didn't know at the time, was that the Soviets were armed on Cuba with tactical nuclear weapons, the purpose of which was to destroy an American invading force. And as I show in my book, they had also deployed tactical nuclear weapons, cruise missiles, to within 15 miles of the Guantanamo naval base. So the first thing that they were planning to do was to wipe out the Guantanamo naval base. And, of course, the American soldiers landing in Cuba would have been potentially wiped out by nuclear strikes as well. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think, very unlikely, that had the Soviets used nuclear weapons on Cuba against an American invading force and against Guantanamo naval base, it's very unlikely that you could have limited such a nuclear exchange to Cuba itself. It would have probably quickly escalated into a nuclear exchange between the two superpowers.
Did the United States know how many Soviet troops there were in Cuba?
They didn't. They had observed all these ships crossing the Atlantic, and they'd done a crude calculation as to how many Soviet soldiers could be on the ships. And McNamara informed Kennedy on October 20th that he thought that there were between 6,000 and 8,000 Soviet technicians on Cuba. In fact, there were 43,000, i.e. 7 or 8 times as many as the American estimate, 43,000 heavily armed Soviet combat troops equipped with tactical nuclear weapons. The scale of the Cuban and Soviet defenses was many more times than the Americans imagined.
On the subject of the quarantine, I believe it is the case that a true blockade would have been considered an act of war. And so what the United States did was steer this narrow course between that and what they were doing, where they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to stop the ships and we're going to see what's going in there. How did they think about that? And did they, in fact, think that that still was going to be a problem and was so provocative that it might indeed provoke a response from the Soviets?
Well, in effect, it was a blockade, although they used a diplomatic term to describe it, a quarantine. And they also got the Organization of American States, the UN of the Americas, to legitimize it by endorsing the American action. So it had a veil of international legitimacy, but it was still, as far as the Soviets were concerned, it was illegitimate, and Khrushchev said he wouldn't respect it, although he actually turned around his missile-carrying ships as soon as he heard about it in order not to challenge the blockade. But he allowed submarines to continue, and there was a confrontation at sea between American warships and Soviet submarines that turn out to have been armed with nuclear torpedoes.
We have another caller here, Champaign County. Let's talk with this listener, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm the one that brings up Turkey all the time and the missiles there. I've heard even the allegation that these were obsoleted weapons. I've heard even heard the idea that Kennedy didn't know they were there still or something like that. What can you do to elucidate that part of the deal that saved us from nuclear war?
Well, that's right. The U.S. had deployed Jupiter intermediate-range missiles in Turkey, and by the time they were deployed, they were effectively obsolete because they were fixed. They were in fixed positions. They were very easily visible. They could have been wiped out in an airstrike, so they weren't much use, and they were, you know, possibly provocative because they could have attracted a Soviet airstrike. And the question was, who controlled them? Did the Americans control them fully, or did the Turks control them? So Kennedy was, you know, wanted to get rid of them. He was only half aware of them. He thought that it'd be much easier to station a nuclear submarine, a Polaris, off the coast of Turkey. So he was not going to go to war over a few obsolete missiles in Turkey. Contrary to the opinion of some of his advisors who thought it would be a diplomatic affront to Turkey to pull the missiles out, Kennedy was not going to make this a casus belli, a cause for war. So he sent his brother, Bobby, to the Soviet embassy on the night of October 27th, the day known as Black Saturday, and said, told the Soviet ambassador that the U.S. would pull its missiles out of Turkey if the Soviets withdrew their missiles from Cuba. And that was the basis for the deal. The following day, Khrushchev announced he was pulling his missiles out of Cuba. But part of the deal was that the withdrawal of U.S. missiles from Turkey would happen in secret, and it would take place over the following 2 months. But Kennedy's insisted that Khrushchev not make that public, and it didn't become public for another 30 or 40 years.
And it still doesn't seem to be figured in much of the discourse around this whole situation. I mean, I think the rest of the world sort of knows that. I've heard it argued that, you know, this belligerence upon LeMay and even Kennedy, a blockade, was seen in the rest of the world as just nuts. To not put a fine point on it, and that it was actually sort of a diplomatic victory for the Soviet Union in a lot of people's eyes, because they looked tractable. They looked, and I know that's totally heretical from the point of view of most of the discourse that goes on in the world here. But
well, the other element in the solution was the U.S. in effect guaranteed Castro's continuation in power, said that we will not attempt to remove Castro by force. We will not invade Cuba. And although Castro, he was felt humiliated by the withdrawal of Soviet missiles, in effect, the Cuban Missile Crisis marks the end of the active U.S. attempts to depose Castro. And, of course, he's still there 45 years later, or 46 years later, and he's just transferred power to his brother, Raul.
Yeah, the modern analogy is so striking. I still don't know how you would come down on this, but the commitment not to try to overthrow and have secret findings against Iran, as we presently see, or we're hearing a little bit about them, Cy Hirsch's article, the idea that one of the things that prevented the deal 2 years ago that the European Union had cut with Iran was the idea that the U.S. was just not going to give a commitment to give up a regime change. And we have, even in the House and the Senate, a resolution that has overwhelming support, apparently, calling for the embargo of refined gasoline products to Iran. I mean, it's I don't know. That's an aside, I guess. But
well, I think it. I mean, there are the Cuban Missile Crisis is a very good historical precedent for you know, crisis that we face now, and I think it's an excellent case study of how an American president takes decisions at a time when confronted by grave international danger. And the fact is that you don't get very far with countries when you're trying to. I mean, it's difficult to negotiate with a country at the same time as you want to topple that country's government. And, you know, we certainly saw that with Cuba, and we've seen it with Iran and probably North Korea as well.
Just to underscore the point there that you were talking about with the caller, that the United States said to the Soviet Union, here's the deal. If you, the Soviet Union, will remove the missiles from Cuba, we, the United States, will do two things. We will promise publicly, and this was out in the open, we will say, we'll make a promise that we're not going to invade Cuba. The other was the secret promise to remove these missiles that we've been talking about from Turkey, which the United States did. And as you say, that it was a long time before it became known that the United States had made that commitment, and that was part of this whole deal. If you look at those two things, is it possible to say that either one or the other, as far as the that the Soviets were concerned, was the more important concession for the United States to make?
Well, I think for Khrushchev it was very important that Kennedy made the non-invasion pledge, because then it allowed Khrushchev to climb down, back down, but still save some face, because he said, he was able to tell his colleagues in the Soviet leadership and to the world that he had saved Castro. He had saved socialism in Cuba. And I think that, you know, that was one of his motivations in sending the missiles to Cuba, so he could claim that he had at least partially fulfilled his original goals. That was very important to him.
Well, you were talking earlier about the fact that it was the plan of the Soviet Union to have the missile, to send the missiles and the troops there, to have them in place and have them ready and operational, and then make the announcement that they were there. And that what happened was that the United States found out before the missiles were operational, and that provoked this crisis. And that meant Mr. Khrushchev had to take a different, his original plan was now off the rails. At what point did he know that, or would he have known that, right at the moment when it became obvious that the United States knew what Soviet Union was doing? At that moment, did he realize that he was going to have to do something different because the original plan just wasn't going to go anymore?
He learned that the same time as the American people learned it, when Kennedy went on television to announce that the U.S. had discovered the presence of Soviet missiles in Cuba and was demanding their removal. Actually, they gave, I think they gave the Soviets an hour's advance notice, but in effect it was at the same time.
We're just a little bit past our midpoint here, and I would like to once again introduce the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Michael Dobbs. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, where he spent much of his career as a foreign correspondent covering the collapse of communism. He's the author of a recently published book. It's about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the title 1 Minute to Midnight, and it's published by Knopf. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that made managing this crisis very difficult was that communications between the two governments, and particularly between the two leaders, were difficult. They did not know one another, and at this point there was no they couldn't just one of them just couldn't pick up the telephone and call and talk to the other. How were communications between the two governments managed, and how perhaps did that complicate this crisis?
Right, and there was no hotline between Washington and Moscow. In fact, the hotline was introduced as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis, precisely for this reason, that they had such difficulty communicating. And it took 12 hours to write a message, to have it coded, to telegram had to be sent by metal wire across the Atlantic, decoded at the other end, retranslated, and so on. that whole procedure could take as long as 12 hours. In fact, the former Soviet ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Dobrynin, he recalls how when they wanted to send a telegram back to Moscow, they would pick up the phone and call the local office of Western Union, and a messenger would appear on a bicycle, and they would entrust their precious telegram, of course it had been coded, to this messenger and watch the messenger cycle away on his bicycle and just hope that he didn't stop for a cup of coffee or to chat with his girlfriend along the way, because, well, peace hung on this telegram arriving at the other end. And on the final day of the crisis, when Khrushchev thought that time was running out, and he was convinced that the Americans were about to attack Cuba, he decided that there wasn't time for the normal procedures. So instead of sending a telegram through the normal diplomatic channels, he had it read aloud on Radio Moscow so that it would be received almost instantaneously by the other side. And so the final Soviet decision to withdraw the missiles was publicly announced on Moscow radio, and it came as a shock not only to the Soviet people but also to Castro, who'd been assured by the Soviets on Cuba that Khrushchev would never do such a thing.
What sort of impact did this have on the relationship between Khrushchev and Castro and between Cuba and the Soviet Union?
Well, it destroyed Castro's trust in his Soviet patrons, and Castro was absolutely livid when he heard about this. It said that he rammed his fist into a mirror and broke the mirror, and he refused to speak to the Soviet ambassador for a few days. One of his aides called up the ambassador and told him that the Soviets were pulling out the missiles, and the ambassador didn't believe it. He said, "You know, don't believe Radio Washington. Don't believe the imperialist propaganda." And he said, wasn't American radio, it was Radio Moscow. So it led to a cooling in relations between the Russians and the Cubans, but Castro realized he had nowhere else to go. So for various reasons, including economic reasons, he was saddled with the Soviet alliance if he wanted to preserve his independence from the United States.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone in Bloomington, Illinois, not too far away, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if your guest is familiar with a book by James Douglas recently published, really about the assassination of Kennedy. But he seems to suggest that out of this crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev shared a horror of nuclear war that made them a little more willing to negotiate and almost comrades in the quest for peace and nuclear disarmament. And even Khrushchev proposed an image of Noah's Ark with clean and unclean animals, and he said, "We don't need to decide who's clean and unclean. We want the Ark to survive." Are you familiar with all that?
I'm not familiar with that book that you mentioned, but I agree with the general conclusion. I do think that Kennedy and Khrushchev ended up pretty much on the same side in the sense that they did share a horror of nuclear war. They'd both been through the Second World War, and they knew that a nuclear war would be much more devastating. And the real threat of war in October 1962 did not come from the conscious decisions of Khrushchev and Kennedy. It came from accidental, unpredictable events that start to happen and will become inevitable once you put the machinery of war into motion. And a very good example of that is that on Black Saturday, October 27th, a American U-2 spy plane was meant to go to the North Pole to pick up evidence of Soviet nuclear tests, and blunders over the eastern part of the Soviet Union on this most critical day of the Cold War. And Khrushchev, the following day, sends a message to Kennedy saying that we could have mistaken this plane for a nuclear bomber. So once you become close to a nuclear war, you know, it can be very difficult to stop this to put a stop to it. Once you go to war, all sorts of unpredictable things happen, as we have seen in Iraq and we saw in the Balkans in Serbia when we bombed the Chinese embassy by mistake. And by Black Saturday in particular, there are many sort of incidents that the president is not aware of, that Khrushchev is not aware of, any one of which could have led to a nuclear war, and that is really the focus of my book.
Well, thank you very much. All right, thank you. I look forward to your book.
Well, and I think that that's an important point, that we perhaps have the idea that that the two leaders, Kennedy, Khrushchev, were the ones who were in control of what was happening and was in control of their military. And what's frightening, and I'm sure probably was frightening for them, was that they weren't, and that there's one example, that this U-2 pilot who blunders into Soviet airspace. The other would be that there was a U-2 that was actually shot down over Cuba by Russian troops there, not because Moscow ordered it, but because they felt threatened, perhaps, or they took the decision on their own to do it. So it was an example that that a mistake or an action independently taken by a commander on the ground somewhere could have tripped things into an entirely different sort of level, and that was something that was really beyond the control of either of the two leaders.
Right. I mean, there were many unauthorized actions taking place, and it's impossible for a president or commander-in-chief to fully control the actions of his own armed forces. In a conventional war, you can afford there's some margin for error, and you can afford some mistakes, but Kennedy was very aware that in a nuclear war, the margin for error is, you know, very, very little. A single mistake can lead to a nuclear exchange. So this is one reason why, at the end, particularly on Black Saturday, it was a kind of race against time. Would they find a way out before some chance event? Another one was the whole question of the submarines. They were the U.S. Navy was trying to surface the Soviet submarines. What they didn't know at the time was that the Soviet submarines were armed with nuclear torpedoes, that the conditions on board those submarines were terrible, that the Soviet sailors were under great stress, and at one point the commander of the submarine even loads a nuclear torpedo, it orders the nuclear torpedo to be loaded into the firing chamber. There were no locks on the nuclear missiles and weapons at that time, so that, in effect, even though, on both sides, both in theory, they couldn't be fired without the approval of the president or the Soviet leader, in practice, they were under the command of lieutenants, captains, majors, sometimes people 30 years old, in effect, controlled a nuclear weapon.
We have other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign on line 4. Hello.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm a truck driver going across here in Champaign. I was in that blockade. I was in the Navy. I was in the troop transport, the Gator fleet. And we didn't know what was happening. Everybody in the United States knew what was happening. And all of a sudden, our captain came on a speaker system and said, "This is what's happening. Castro did this, Castro did that." We had 16,000 Marines we dropped off in Guantanamo. They dug in. Everybody had live ammunition. We knew something was up. And we went out and joined the blockade. And I seen the Russian fleet, and we outnumbered them. But we did stop one Russian merchant ship, and we signaled to him to stand dead in the water, and he wouldn't. Pretend like he didn't know English. We ran flags up to stop. We still won. We fired one on a 5-inch gun across his bow, in front of his bow, and then all of a sudden he understood English. And the scary part is, I was a young man of 18, only a year in the Navy, and I've seen the Russian cruisers made ours look small, but we outnumbered them. But we never knew how close we were to a war, because we didn't have cell phone in those days or nothing. But we had 16,000 Marines that we dropped off, and we thought we outnumbered them. That's the first I heard they had 43,000 Russian troops there.
What ship were you on board?
The USS Rockbridge, APA 228. I used to drive the landing craft. Matter of fact, when Nam broke out, I made the first landing in Nam. happen?
Well, you know, we were planning a amphibious assault on Cuba during this period, and in effect, it was would have been very similar to the landings in Normandy at D-Day,
right.
along a similar stretch of coastline and similar numbers of troops involved. What, of course, we didn't know at the time was that the many more Soviets, combat soldiers, supporting the Cubans than we had estimated, and they were armed with tactical nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well, they had, matter of fact, my ship was from the Second World War. We used them in Nam. I drove the LCMs and LZVs. And like I say, we had 16,000 Marines right out of boot camp. And they thought, well, we thought we were doing good. We didn't had no idea there were so many troops there. And thank God it didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling in and telling us the story.
Oh, thank you very much.
We appreciate it. We had about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Well, actually, maybe more like 7-8 minutes. Our guest is Michael Dobbs. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He's the author of a recent book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The title of his book is 1 Minute to Midnight, and it's published by Knopf. We have another caller here, someone who is in Chicago. Let's talk with them. Line 2. Hello.
Thank you. To point out the occurrence of recent miscarriage of the transport of nuclear weaponry on some planes within our country here. We had the Secretary of Defense, DeGates, order the removal of the head of the that branch of the Air Force and all subsequent command under that mishandled that event recently that was brought to the public's attention. But then going back to the matter of the actual decision between Kennedy and Khrushchev to have calmer heads prevail rather than have a military decision being made. It was a result of one person, as I understand, that stated that they knew Khrushchev and they knew that in some manner, to speak, he did not want an actual conflagration to occur. And he prevailed over the military group that was in session there that on the basis of his knowing Khrushchev more to get Kennedy and Khrushchev to actually get down to talking, and we'll see the result of a calmer, cooler heads prevailing over the military, as in the case of Truman and MacArthur and other things that we can cite. I thought I'd offer that to you. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thanks for mentioning the point about how nuclear weapons are handled nowadays, and the fact that the head of the Air Force or senior Air Force commander was dismissed because of improper handling of nuclear warheads. Of course, back in 1962, you know, it was all many of the procedures that are now in place weren't in place in those days. And as soon as the missile crisis erupted, the first thing that happened was that nuclear bombers had to be dispersed all over the United States to various civilian airfields with live nuclear weapons on board. Also, the fighter interceptors that would have, whose mission was to defend the country from a Soviet bombing attack, they were also dispersed to airfields all over the country. So you had live nuclear weapons being dispersed across the country under conditions that were very difficult to keep, you know, complete tabs on. And I was reminded of that with this latest incident. But back in October 1962, this was happening on a, you know, hourly, daily basis, that planes loaded with nuclear weapons were flying into remote airfields. And, you know, on at least one occasion, there was one of those planes overshot the runway and was involved in what could have been a fatal accident.
Near the end of the book, or right at the end of the book in the afterword, you mention here, include a quote from Dean Acheson, who was the Secretary of State for Harry Truman and was one of the people that Kennedy asked to take part in the discussions here to advise him as to what to do in this crisis. And that he apparently said that it was essentially just luck that the United States and the Soviet Union avoided going to war. And I suppose that there are indeed some people who would make that same argument, that this was a matter of luck. And it's something, though, I think that you would really want to dispute, that it was not luck, that it was in large part the determination of the two men, Kennedy and Khrushchev, to have a peaceful resolution.
Well, yeah, the quote from Acheson was just dumb luck that the Kennedys avoided a nuclear war. And I think Jack Kennedy's, when he heard that remark, or Bobby Kennedy said, yeah, we were lucky we didn't listen to Acheson, because Acheson had proposed a air attack followed by an invasion. But I think there was, you know, an element of luck in it, that, you know, one of these incidents, including the incident of the U-2 pilot overflying Soviet airspace, could have resulted in, you know, something much more serious. But people make their luck, and you know, we were fortunate to have people as leaders, as level-headed as Kennedy and Khrushchev. I'm not uncritical of them by any means, because I think that in their different ways they helped to bring the crisis about. But during the 13 days themselves, both showed, you know, considerable wisdom and statesmanship, and they were well aware of the, you know, scale of a war that could result. So there was an element of luck in it, but it wasn't dumb luck, and in the end we were fortunate in the leaders we had at the time.
Well, there's also another famous quote associated with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I don't recall now who said it. I think it may have been misattributed, but anyway, it was the quote about, we were eyeball to eyeball and the other guy blinked. And it's in so much of how I think people have thought about this, they pictured in terms of a kind of conflict between the two sides, and that it was one where one side won, the other side lost. Is that the wrong way, do you think, to think about this?
Well, that quote is from Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State at the time, when the U.S. heard that the Soviet ships had turned around. In fact, as I show in the book, that incident never took place, at least as it was imagined by the American side, and as you can see it depicted in the movie 13 Days. Khrushchev had decided to turn his missile-carrying ships around almost immediately, so they were a long way from the blockade line when Rusk made that famous statement. And I think that really goes to the heart of the danger we ran back in October 62. It was not the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between these two leaders. The real risk came from the unpredictable events that happen once you put these war machines into motion. The chances of something going wrong increase exponentially. And in a nuclear war, or when you're preparing for a nuclear war, and in fact we saw the initial stages of a nuclear war on Black Saturday, there's no margin for error at all.
And something else, and just very quickly, it seems, though, that this had an effect on the way the United States thought about diplomacy, or the need for diplomacy, and that is it went to this mindset that says all you have to do is hang tough, be determined, maintain your political will, then you'll win. Well, that doesn't always work.
Well, of course, after the event, the Kennedys had an interest in spinning the crisis that way. They wanted to make the president seem tough. In fact, if you go back and listen to the EXCOM tapes that are available, you see that of all the people in the room, the president was in fact the most was willing to go the furthest to avoid a attack on Cuba. So, you know, he was the most prepared to make concessions to Khrushchev in order to avoid a nuclear war. But that was not the way it was spun by, you know, his brother and various Kennedy aides. The way it was spun was that this had been a superb example of crisis management, with Kennedy playing Khrushchev like a violin. But that was not how it seemed at the time.
We'll have to leave it at that. I guess Michael Dobbs, he's a reporter for The Washington Post. His book is 1 Minute to Midnight, published by Knopf. Mr. Dobbs, thank you very much.
It's been good to be with you. Thank you.
Right now, we'll have to take our usual break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the prices. September wheat in Kansas City at $9.50, up 10.5. December, $9.23, up 7.25. At the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat, $8.67, up 7.25. December, $8.97, up 12.25. March, $9.18, up 9. September corn, $5.69, up 16.